early this morning, apparently in an attempt to either scare the Iranians or calm the markets, President Trump issued yet another ultimatum. None of the last ones have worked, at least the last few. We'll see whether this one does again. But if that was not intended to be a real thing and something that he just wanted to scare people by saying that he was going to completely obliterate all of their electric generating plants, oil wells in Karg Island, and possibly desalinization plants, if that was just an empty threat, you wouldn't know it by watching the conference of this press conference today with Caroline Leavitt, because she seemed to double down on all of this stuff.
One way or another, Iran will no longer have the credible ability to threaten the United States or our allies, which is, of course, the overall objective and mission the president set out when he launched Operation Epic Fury. This remains a truly once-in-a-generation opportunity for the regime to make a good deal with the United States, permanently abandon their nuclear ambitions, and stop acting as the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. If the Iranians reject this golden opportunity, the greatest military in the history of the world continues to stand by to provide President Trump with every option available to ensure this regime continues to pay a grave price.
Continues to pay a grave price, man. You know, I just really, and look, this was just kind of as a personal aside here. She started this whole press conference off by talking about how the president and her and the first lady were all having a lovely little prayer ceremony. And did you hear us with our amens and stuff? You know, don't start something like that, walk in and then talking about how you're going to be death and destruction on a war we started. I mean, Jesus was about the Prince of Peace. We're about to celebrate the Passover, and then we're going to celebrate the Christian side, of course, is going to be celebrating the resurrection of Jesus, the death, burial, and resurrection. Not a good look to be saying, yes, you should all look to the Prince of Peace as we throw bombs on somebody who did nothing to us. It's just not a good look. It doesn't help the gospel, and it just undercuts anything that we say in terms of having any kind of morality. Better leave that off the table. But even just looking at it foreign policy-wise, you have the same kind of an issue here. Here again, she just doubles down on this. You know, it sounded kind of mafioso. Hey, you know what? You got a good deal here. You're going to take the deal, or are we going to have to do it the hard way? You know what I'm saying? I mean, that kind of animalistic and kind of cheap sort of theatrics. I mean, if that was ever going to have worked, it would have already worked by now. I mean, have we not validated enough that all these threats and all these things we're going to do and places we're going to blow up have no effect on them now? We've opened it up to a full war. There's really nothing left that we can bring to bear that's not already fallen on a daily basis. We continue to bomb them relentlessly every night, blow stuff up, kill a bunch of people, and they are not backing down. So just adding a few more words to this is not going to work. And you know, and continuing on with the trend, unfortunately, where she's saying, you know, this is a great opportunity for you. Who is going to take it, you know, a great opportunity? Who is going to see it that way? If you're given all these threats and that's empty, that's just bouncing off their ear because they're like, what are you talking about? You're already doing this. You have nothing else to add to it. And then you also say, this is about negotiations. Now, I admit that may just be for a domestic audience. That may be for all the writers in the room where she's talking to make them think that, oh, well, look, we're still willing to be reasonable. If they'll just come to the table, they've always been at the table. It's us who blew them away with the blast from a bomb. They were willing. They came hat in hand, like the best case scenario that you could have ever asked for before this. And we rejected it and said, no, here's some more bombs in your face. How about that? So then why would you expect him to come to the table now? So we can only imagine that one of two things is generally going to be true. Either we are absolutely delusional and we believe what we're saying, and we actually are surprised that they're not coming to the table again after they've already been fooled all these different times, or we're just lying and we have no intention to do that, and we're just going to continue on with the war. Here's the problem. Either one of those alternatives has some really, really big problems for us, because there are consequences that are now starting to compile. We've tried to push a lot of them off with words, but it's just not working. And now then the pain is starting to bite a little bit, but there's a lot worse to come. we're not doing ourselves any favor. And then further on, even if you wanted to have some negotiations, then the last thing that you would have done is said, hey, you know what? How about we just steal their oil? As if all this is Rosemary Kalanick. She's been on our show here recently, kind of a rising star in the foreign policy world here in the United States. Really good analysis. And this is one of them. She says, it's as if the war isn't dumb enough already. I love the way she starts. Trump tells FT he wants to take Iran's oil. According to the FT, Trump said, to be honest with you, my favorite thing is to take the oil in Iran. But some stupid people back in the U.S. say, why are you doing that? But they're stupid people. Such a move, as the Rose continues to write, would involve seizing Karg Island, through which most of Iran's oil is exported. I got news, she says. If U.S. takes Karg, the Iranians will shut off the tap. But that explains why the president might take the island of Karg occupation as opposed to just bombing it. He doesn't want to damage the facilities. He's hoping the U.S. could control it later. Also, he's hoping to turn Iran into Venezuela under Delcy Rodriguez. Iran isn't Venezuela, she correctly points out there. And that's one of the things we certainly need to talk about here, because too many evidences are starting to emerge and too many conversations I've had with people who have some knowledge about the inner workings of the administration. There were those in the administration, maybe all the way up to the president himself, that thought this was going to be something like Venezuela. To where you could go in, you could talk bombastically, you could issue ultimatums, and then you make a deal with somebody on the inside and you come in with a big fire and fury kind of moment, lots of explosions, helicopters, missiles, all kinds of stuff. Then you have a daring raid. This is starting to sound familiar with what people are thinking now. You have a daring raid, you go in and you steal away the president. Of course, you had some inside help with Delcy Rodriguez, by all accounts. And you are able to take him with no casualties. You get off, you leave, you kill a few people to make it look good, like good movie industry stuff. And then you fly out. Big, big time success, big victory. And we walked away. And Rose is right. Iran is not Venezuela. And there was many reasons why that it was at least plausible. And even, by the way, even the Venezuela situation, even with all the corruption they have, it was still a big risk, because all you needed was one or two people not to get the memo or not to agree to it or stab somebody in the back. And this thing could have gone really bad. You remember that big scene where there was helicopters just rolling against the night sky and you had these flames in the background, the video in the front, really dramatic stuff. But if somebody had decided, you know what, forget that, we're going to take those helicopters under fire, you'd have been seeing a bunch of them nose down in flames with all kinds of casualties, because they're really vulnerable. There's very little you can do to protect yourself in a helicopter. But everything did go well and nothing did go bad. But unfortunately, in President Trump's mind, it's the same thing over here. And so he's thinking, yeah, I'll just take the oil. I'm going to say with the one hand, either you do this stuff or we're going to kill everybody, but I want you to come to negotiation. I still think we're going to get a deal, he said earlier in the day, but I'm also going to take their oil, which would literally sabotage any possibility of a negotiated settlement. There is no conception on the planet that the Iranians are going to have some kind of negotiation like the Venezuelans did, that said at the end of the day, we'll agree to stop fighting. We'll agree to stop all the war as long as you stop shooting us. And yes, sure, take the oil. I still to this day don't really understand why the people in Venezuela chose that path. Maybe they think that they can undo it later. I don't know. But the idea that the Iranians would do it was, you know, off the charts crazy, for all the cultural, historical, and regional issues that are involved there. There's no way that they would ever do that. I mean, that's literally their lifeblood, and there's nothing else. And it's their culture, so they're certainly not going to do that. Well, that's not the only problem, because now then you have to say, okay, well, if that doesn't work, if we don't succeed with that, then the question is going to be, what next can we do? So if you can't blow them to smithereens, and you're not going to negotiate because you've literally just undercut your own position, not to mention what you did to undercut it before you got into this, then maybe some other people are still whispering in President Trump's ear, maybe we can go in and do something on the ground. Here's Jim Hansen, who went on Fox News, who is going to argue maybe that's what we should do.
Get out of kinetic operation soon, if he has to use ground troops to finish that, that's not a red line for us.
Oh, got the wrong one. Although that does still work here. But let me back it up to the right spot here. It's about right there.
Assad, and probably there are, you know, our own little covert operators doing their things. But one of the main things we have to get is the enriched uranium. You know, they either have to give that up or maybe we go get it. You know, it's a hellish concept to think we have to go and go underground and try to grab that stuff and leave. But that's one of the potential missions for those guys, as I mentioned. I think they are much better as a threat. But in this situation, President Trump has to finish the job.
President Trump has to finish the job. Are you kidding me? I mean, who even looks at a map? Let me just toss this one up here, just this one little simple one map here. Who can look at this map, this relief map of Iran, and say we're going to, quote, finish the job with a handful of troops? I mean, seriously. Again, for context here, that's four times geographically bigger than the country of Iran. And unlike Iran, which was mostly flat plains that you could just drive easily over, you see that this is mainly mountainous ranges in the entire western part of the country. So what do you mean you're going to finish the job? And you're going to do what on the ground? You're going to be a dot on the map. Anywhere that we have troops right now would be just a few. I mean, the most it's even been talked about in terms of combat troops is 17,000. As far as I'm aware, at least publicly, nothing else has even been mobilized. So that's not going to happen. You're not going to go anywhere. That's not going to finish any job. All you're going to be doing there is putting more Americans in body bags and more people that are going to get wounded. And you're going to further damage and diminish our value as an armed forces, because people are starting to see around the world, man, you guys claim that, just as Caroline Leavitt foolishly again said there in that opening clip, you know, we're the strongest, most amazing military in the history of the world and all this, and we're going to bring it to bear. Dude, open your eyes. People are watching. They are paying attention and they see with their own eyes. You are not the most incredible military power on the face of the planet. You can't even bring little Iran to its knees. And even though they're geographically a big country, they're they've always been a kind of a middling power in the Middle East. And as long as you don't attack them, as long as you don't play into their strengths, they were never going to launch a war against us. And they have adamantly refused to get drawn into a war, even though we've had all kinds of provocations, almost begging them to do it, like assassinating their senior four-star general, which President Trump did, like blowing up their embassy in another country, as Israel did, like assassinating people in their capital city during an inauguration, like Israel did. All of this was to try and to spark a larger war, and they resisted because they didn't want to. They never got a nuclear weapon. Ever since 2003, when they had a religious fatwa against it, all the way through to the beginning of this one, all the way through to the beginning of the one in 2025, they didn't. We allegedly obliterated it, certainly caused profound damage on their capabilities. Our own director of national intelligence reaffirmed about a week or so ago that there had been no move to reposition it, to bring it back into life. Just a few people claimed that was happening, but no evidence. In fact, the what evidence we had in the official statement of the U.S. government was that they had not. So there was none of that. So if they weren't attacking anybody and they didn't go to war when they had a chance and they didn't make a nuclear weapon, even when we gave them every reason to, then you can't now say that they're this leading thing of terrorism that we have to risk going in on the ground to get. So you're seeing this is already starting to fall apart here. And then, you know, you also, let's talk about this, because the other thing he's talking about, maybe we got to go get that enriched uranium. And of course, we've had Trina Parsi on earlier today, and he was talking about what would happen if the U.S. tries to have a raid or something like that in Karg Island or in Kashim or in some of the other smaller islands that Trina told us about. That was the first time I'd heard about those, some small islands in the Horseshoe Bend, different than the Kashim. You have the same issue there, that the high risk, high probability of failure, but difficult to do. This guy, Hansen, was talking about what many others are talking about, is to go somewhere deep inside the country to retrieve the nuclear material. Now, there's many places that it could be, but I mean, one of the most rational, logical places would be to put it in a place where, you know, nobody else could get at it. For example, where did that one go? Let me pull that one up here. Let's say, here's where I would certainly put it. I would put it in the Yaz Granite Fortress, one where we know we've attacked many times. We've tried to get them because we know they have missile facilities, and you see all those things depicted on the screen there. I mean, how in God's name could you go into a facility like this and actually break into it and think you're going to find this stuff? I mean, you realize some of this stuff is 500 feet down inside of a mountain, which obviously has limited areas of access, plenty of people inside of it were to support it. And then there's no doubt it would be multiple levels inside to defend even against that. I mean, did no one think of that? Did no one think that they're probably going to put it in something impenetrable like this that you would need an army to go get? You're not going to have a raid to go pick up something like this. And that's if they have it all in one place, which would be foolish on their part, but not completely out of the question. With a facility like that, maybe they make the argument that it's so impenetrable that you can't get at it. So I don't know what we're thinking about, but so you're not going to get that. You're not going to get the reprocessed material. You're not going to force them into getting to turning this back over. But look, there's also other issues. It's not even just the oil. We talk about the oil price a lot. There's other things you might not think about, like helium. This is a health ranger on here who's actually reposted a lot of our posts on here. How are you, health ranger? Good to see you. But you see, he said, listen, the world is about to experience the most dramatic and catastrophic helium shortage in history, something you may not be thinking about. But his lab uses helium. We stocked up weeks ago, but it won't last forever. And then the key part here, microchip lithography fabrications require helium. No helium means no more GPUs will be manufactured, no AI chips for Tesla, no high-band memory chips. And then so you see that this quickly starts affecting everything high-tech in the government. Everything in our economy is all driven on that stuff. That is now, we're talking a near-term problem here. We have the problem with agriculture. We have the problem with diesel. We have the problem with regular gasoline. Natural gas, stuff that has feedstocks, not just for other things with it to do with AI chip making, but also powering electric plants for economic energy all over the planet. All of these things are starting to come together. And we're starting to see more and more. Look, we don't have the capability militarily to get rid of this. We can't solve this militarily. You've got to understand that. I think we beat that horse well enough. But we also, I won't say we can't solve this diplomatically. We won't solve it diplomatically because of our malfeasance before and our abject humiliation of the term diplomacy and how we have shredded our credibility by thinking that we were in a position of strength and we could do whatever we want. We didn't have to follow rules. And if we wanted a lot of people that were doing diplomacy, but really we're just buying time, and then we'll go kill them. And then as President Trump bragged one day ago, and we showed that soundbite earlier, where he says, yeah, we were negotiating, but then we had to go bomb them. And then we're negotiating some more. And then we bombed them again. And now I think we're going to get a deal again. I mean, either he is off his rocker and he has some sort of dementias really creeping in, or he's getting incredibly bad advice, or he has no morals. I don't know which it is. And it may be a combination of all three of those. But it is not grounded in any sort of reality. Nothing as a leader of our country that's going to get us out of this. And look, we've talked about economics and military stuff. This is also having diplomatic problems of a different nature. Let's take a look at some of that here. This is the defense minister of Spain, who's saying, listen, forget about it, not forget about coming to help you. I think we showed you President Trump was complaining earlier today about France and UK and Germany that we're not sending military aspects. France is saying, you know what? Stay out of our air.
Desde el primer momento se le trasladó clarísimamente al ejército americano y a las fuerzas americanas y por lo tanto ni se autorizan las bases y por supuesto tampoco se autoriza la utilización del espacio aéreo español para actuaciones que tengan que ver con la guerra en Irán, para ir una guerra contra la que estamos totalmente en contra, en la que no creemos, que nos parece profundamente ilegal y profundamente injusta.
So you see, look, man, people are starting to say, you know what? I don't trust anything that you guys say. It's illegal. It's ineffective. And now then there are people that are willing to stand up against us. So we showed you earlier today, Keir Starmer said, this is not our war. We're not fighting it. Friedrich Merz said, we're not going to do it. France, we're not going to send any of our ships in there. Then you had Trump in reciprocal mocking NATO, rather. and say, well, yeah, oh, you know, British said they would give us an aircraft carrier. We don't need that. We've already won the war. Yeah, we've already won the war. So one of our aircraft carriers, USS Gerald R. Ford, had to go back because it couldn't continue to operate anymore. And now we're bringing in another one of ours. So nobody else is willing to help us because we're burning bridges, even with our allies, much less in Europe, much less with our actual adversary in Iran. But it's not even just that. There's also our allies in the Middle East. And this here to out today, foreign minister of Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt met in Islamabad today to figure out how to end the war in the Middle East. Notice who was not in the room. The United States. The United States delivered a 15-point action plan and a deadline. Iran called the demands unreasonable and actions contradictory. So the region simply organized itself without Washington, assembled a new diplomatic bloc in real time, and started talking. The U.S. did not decline the invitation. It was not sent one. And therein you have, now then you're starting to see stuff fall apart all over the place. In Europe, in the Middle East, in Asia, even our ally, South Korea, is having to ration fuel. Others like the Philippines, Vietnam, and several others in the region are already struggling because of the cutoff, because of the war that we started. Natural gas, oil is not getting through, so it's already having impacts on just the normal daily lives over there. And it started to have a problem here. Now, we're a bit shielded more from it in the United States because we have our own oil. But the price is still a global commodity, so it's going up, whereas some of these other countries, especially in Asia, are profoundly dependent upon oil coming out of the Middle East. And so they're some of the big bill payers already. Now we see the economic impacts in Asia with the helium, and that has to do with making chips, which has to do with everything in the Western world. Our entire economy is high tech and based upon those kind of chips. I mean, everything from refrigerators to your phone to your cars. I mean, there's almost nothing that's left out of that. Taiwan is one of the biggest makers of all of this in the world. I think something like 70%, if I'm not mistaken. They're struggling. They're about a couple of weeks away from not being able to keep up with production rates anymore, and they're going to have to start curtailing. And if it doesn't get solved pretty quick, they may have to cut it off entirely. This is a big deal, folks. And listen, it's worse than that even, because not only is Iran not cowed, not only do we not have the military capacity to bring them to heel, our threats don't work. Even if we send in the military on the ground, that's not going to bring, because we don't have enough. And it's a huge country anyway. And not only are our European allies kind of embarrassed and pushing against us, not only are our Middle Eastern allies starting to look to a world without us, even with Iran itself, they're starting to say, hey, you know what? I think we can handle a lot of this stuff even better than what you think. Take a look at this one here. U.S. sanctions waiver just handed to Iran nearly doubled its entire yearly budget. Just as a quick reminder, we removed temporarily, the claim is, some of the sanctions, oil sanctions on Iran, to, you remember, Scott Bessent, to out-jujitsu the Iranians by letting them have more oil than they did before. And check out this. The math is devastating. Trump's waiver unlocked nearly roughly 170 million barrels of Iranian crude worth an estimated $14 billion. Iran's entire 2024 military budget was $7.9 billion. One policy decision gave Tehran almost twice that in a single stroke. And at 20,000 per Shahid drone, that money theoretically buys 700,000 of them in the event that they wanted to go. And you see that the math continues to go on there, working against us. So we're actually in the process here because we need the oil out and we need the price to stay stabilized. And let's see, what is it as we're talking about here now? It's eked up to 105 and 104.17 in the WTI, and in the West Texas Intermediate, it's up to 114. Listen, this stuff is just going to keep going. And where are we going to go from here? How are we going to solve this? You can see in this one quick survey here, everywhere you want to look, our public relations campaign is foundering. Our military campaign can't sustain itself. Of course, I didn't even talk any about the fact that we've used up a substantial portion of our Tomahawk offensive cruise missiles. We've used up huge amounts of our THAAD high-altitude defense missiles, interceptors, PAC-3 interceptors, Arrow 2 and 3 interceptors in Israel, all running really low. Our defense industrial base can't make a fraction of a dent in what we're losing already. We just can't keep going on. The price of oil is going up. We're still experiencing casualties. Our friends in the region are suffering. Now we're threatening to take it into the energy infrastructure. Apparently, Israel already did hit Iran with some of that, and they have now started hitting back at some of it. So like in Qatar with some of their gas fields are already, it's going to take years to recover if the war stopped today, but it's not. So these things are going to be compounded. I mean, even if you had some magic formula to get the strait opened up tomorrow, a lot of these things are going to take years to unwind. So we're already at a sustained rate of damage at a time when global economies, especially in the West, in general, the U.S. in particular, are very fragile and weak. And now you want to add something like this sustained on top of them, where it's not just the price of oil and the gasoline and the diesel, but so many of the other feedstocks that go into it and agriculture and everything. I mean, we are genuinely setting up a perfect storm here. Who can weather this storm the longest? By all accounts, it appears the Iranian side can. They have looked forward to this day with trepidation. They didn't want it, but they prepared for it. So they were ready to sustain a long conflict. The facilities like the one at Yazd, I showed you a minute ago, is one of allegedly 27 throughout the country. Don't know if they're all that big, but they apparently are all that protected. And you can imagine in these underground cities, they have substantial resources stored away. So they can continue to fight for a long time. You see, we're giving them cash more than they had. I think it was 1.1 million barrels to date. $45 is what the average they were getting prior to the start of this conflict. Now it's 1.5 million barrels a day at over $100. So more than double the amount that they were making per barrel, and substantially more number of barrels. So they're just swimming in cash right now. And that cash register is going to keep on ka-chinging every day right now, because we can't afford to shut it down. We can't afford to knock out Karg Island. We can't afford to block the strait ourselves or prevent them, because then the oil for us would continue to go up even higher and everybody would pay a price for that. You see, we've got ourselves in this nearly non-winnable situation. How are we ever going to get out of it? I fear that we're going to get out of it because we end up losing, because the world can't, you need to understand something here. Right now, this is shocking to most of the world. They cannot believe we're in this situation, and they figure somebody's going to blink here really quick. So they're all getting nervous, and you see people in Europe are talking, you see people in the Middle East are now assembling without us, because they're trying to look, all right, what are we going to do if they don't blink? If neither one of them blink, what are we going to do? They're having to figure some stuff out. Can we accelerate production? Can we get it out through other ways? Whatever. People in Asia are definitely interested in that. I would imagine that they're probably in contact with a lot of these folks in the Middle East, because they're looking for any kind of other ways that has nothing to do with the U.S. They've got a near-term problem. Now, people are in shock right now, but it's not too many more of these weeks that these painful points right now are going to start gouging deep and starting really hurting. And then people are going to be putting all kinds of pressure on the United States, especially to end this. And there's going to be pressure from our allies, from our adversaries, everybody. Meanwhile, China and Russia are sitting there going, yeah, throw yourself, impale yourself into this, destroy yourself, use up all your stocks. Keep on firing those Tomahawks. Keep on firing those interceptor missiles until you don't have any left. And then pretty soon you're not going to have any friends left either. So they don't have to worry about it at the moment. They don't have to worry about going to war with us, because we're going to self-implode. We're going to destroy our own case. And this mockery of a confident statement like what Caroline Leavitt said at the start of this show about how we're repeating what Trump says, that we're the greatest military power in the history, is going to be one of the epithets that are going to be humiliation to our eternal shame was ever uttered out loud, because it will be having exposed as being complete fraud. And now, friends, everything about the world that we've known since for most of our lives, and I'm 63 years old, everything I've known about my whole life predicated on the U.S. being the number one power economically and militarily in the world, and setting the standards that everybody else follows, and that's why we have a good life. That's now at risk of being completely upended. And no one knows what would happen then. Even I can't predict what may happen then. I can tell you why we're in the position we are, but I can't tell you what would happen after that point. But it would be bad, because the world is going to figure out a way without us at the top. And we won't be able to do anything about it, because we will have exposed that our military is nowhere near what has been claimed all these years, not even just with Trump. It was always that way, and it was always waiting for someone to finally test us. And that day is now upon us. Now the world is already actively trying to figure out what's going to come next, because I don't see how President Trump can't use the military. There's no military solution to solve this, so he's not going to get it done that way. The only thing left is to accept humiliation and eat a lot of crow and have a negotiated settlement where we clearly don't come out the winner. I'll just tell you right now, there's no scenario where this ends, no scenario that doesn't leave Iran in control of the Strait of Hormuz. They've said that out loud, and logic confirms that. There's no way you're going to get around that. So that's already, we're going to be in a far worse condition than before we chose this foolish war than when we got in it. The only question now is how much worse, because we can make it a lot worse. We can try some kind of raid or something else on the ground. It's going to get a lot of Americans killed. It's going to fail. It's going to make Iran look stronger and more confident. And then there'll be the threat. Do we double down? Do we try something bigger on the ground? Do we build up combat power, which would be just catastrophic? Or, as I keep warning about, and the fear of this will grow much stronger on the backside of a failed raid, will we use nuclear weapons to try and solve it militarily so we don't have to eat any crow? And then, man, the whole world order is turned upside down. God only knows what may happen next. And that's why this is a much more serious issue than we think. This is not just about Trump's being embarrassed or whatever. This is about the global order that has existed since the end of World War II is over. It's already over. We just don't know what it's going to end up like, but we know that because of our foolish lies and deception and the shredding of diplomacy and the choosing of the getting rid of the rule of law, getting rid of the constitutional guardrails, getting rid of all of that, and just going by the rule of jungle. Those comments that I've showed you in the past from January of this year will definitely come back to haunt us and every single individual that uttered them, about how there is no rule of law. There's just the rule of the jungle and we're the lion. Remember that? Remember how confident and cocky they were saying it? I bet they won't be on the backside of this. But we're going to have to wait and find out here. We're going to stay on top of this like we always do for you here at the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Anything happens on the ground or any other big developments, you can count on us bringing it to you. And we will see you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.